Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Sean Lacefield, and I represent Mr. White, the appellant in this matter. This morning, I would like to discuss why the record, the appropriate standard of review, and the controlling law allow this court to reverse Mr. White's convictions for robbery and harassment. When trial court removed the necessary act for accomplice liability from the accomplice liability instruction, it did two things. It impermissibly lowered the prosecution's burden of proof, and it prevented Mr. White from presenting his defense, which was that he was present at the scene, but not actually committing a crime. This court has repeatedly held that tendering an instruction that is refused preserves that issue for review. Tendering an instruction effectively accomplishes the purpose of issue preservation for a number of reasons. It informs the trial court that there is an issue with the accomplice liability instruction. It provides notice to the people of the defense position as to the accomplice liability instruction, and it allows the parties to resolve that issue by squaring the court's proposed instruction with the defense's tendered instruction.
Do we know whether the instruction given was one tendered by the prosecution or was some kind of a hybrid created by the trial court looking at both the tender of the prosecution and the defense?
You know, I don't believe that the record is clear in that respect. I believe that the prosecution did tender instructions. I don't believe that they're found in the record.
But we don't know.
So yes, I don't believe that that's clear. Defense counsel cited Bogdanov v. People on her proposed jury instruction when that was tendered. And the arguments raised in Bogdanov are the same arguments that are raised here. Number one, that the instruction violated the defendant's right to due process of law, which includes the right to require the prosecution to prove all the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, and to require that the court properly instruct the jury on all those elements so that the jury is the one making that determination as to whether that burden has been met. When the court applies the constitutional harmless, if I could back up, the standard of review regarding legal challenges to jury instructions, I would submit as a de novo standard of review. When the court shifts to determine whether there is a constitutional harmless error, once the issue has been preserved, the court is required to review the record as a whole and all of the jury instructions that have been submitted to the jury in this case. First, it's the trial court's duty to properly instruct the jury on the law. When it fails to do so, arguments and evidence cannot substitute for proper instructions from the court. There is no way to read this accomplice liability instruction such that it is consistent with the elements that are required to prove someone's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt when pursuing a theory of accomplice liability.
See, were we to conclude that the evidence was overwhelming as to the omitted element, couldn't we still affirm?
Yes, under harmless error. I'm not saying that this is a structural error, but under harmless error analysis, yes, that's correct. And the analysis is not whether in a trial that occurred without the error, a guilty verdict would surely have been rendered, but whether the guilty verdict actually rendered in this trial was surely unattributable to the error. And I don't believe that the evidence is overwhelming. When you go through the record, you see that Ms. White, one of the prosecution witnesses, testified that she went to talk with the alleged victim, Ms. Charisse, at both the daycare center where some of the acts occur, and then at the parking lot when she's unable to have the conversation with her at the daycare center. She describes no physical altercation at the daycare center other than when she, Ms. White, one of the prosecution witnesses, and to Mr. White, pushes Ms. Charisse once the two of them are inside the daycare facility and removed from any of the other individuals who were there. Neither of the two uninterested witnesses who testified about what they observed at the daycare center ever identified Mr. White as being the individual that they saw commit any acts at the daycare center. They talk about what they observed in terms of an individual approaching a car and kicking, but never once does either one of those witnesses identify Mr. White. In fact, one of them originally told law enforcement that the individual that she saw was a Hispanic male, which Mr. White is not. She later changed her story and told law enforcement that it was a white male that she saw.
Could I have you back up and clarify the standard of review here?
Please.
Okay, let's assume the act element is missing. All right. We can look at the record and see overwhelming evidence and just say he's guilty? Or do we look at the instructions to see if the jury was instructed elsewhere? I'm confused.
I believe that it's a de novo standard of review as to the legal challenges to the jury instructions under People v. Lucas.
Okay, so we're going to look at the instructions anew, afresh.
Correct.
Now, your position is if there's overwhelming evidence of guilt, even if an essential element is missing completely from all instructions, that we can nonetheless affirm. Is that what I heard you say, or did I misunderstand that?
It's my understanding under United States Supreme Court precedent, as well as the Colorado Supreme Court, that an omitted or misdescribed element, which I believe that this would be, does not necessarily constitute structural error. So that necessarily means that it lends itself to a harmless error analysis.
But how do we play the harmless error analysis? Just looking at overwhelming evidence of guilt?
No, the first step is that once that error has been established, then the burden shifts to the prosecution, to the people in this case, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error in this case did not contribute to Mr. White's conviction. So that is the analysis. I believe as a part of that analysis, the court can look at and determine whether or not there is overwhelming evidence of guilt. But ultimately, it is the burden that is placed on the people in this case to present beyond a reasonable doubt that the error that occurred, and there is error, did not contribute to Mr. White's convictions.
Well, White's theory of defense instructions stated that he did not rob or attempt to rob the victim. He was simply assisting his sister with getting back her stolen belongings. By assisting, is he not admitting the element that you're claiming missing from the record?
No, Your Honor. When you review the theory of the defense instruction with some of the argument and some of the evidence, you see that by assisting, he is there simply to essentially protect his sister. There was testimony and there was argument about Miss White's belief from her familiarity with Miss Charisse that she was bigger and meaner and essentially a fighter.
Well, but what's the act? I mean, what's the element that you're claiming missing?
That he committed no act. The jury was not instructed that they must find beyond a reasonable doubt that he aided, abetted, encouraged, or advised.
But he's admitting to assisting.
He's admitting to being there. He is admitting to being there to protect his sister in the event that Ms. Charisse becomes upset or enraged about the questions that are being asked about Ms. White's belief that she had stolen her purse. So the assist is simply in his presence to make sure that if she's attacked, his sister is attacked, that he's able to defend her.
Didn't the sister's testimony supply the overwhelming evidence? She said, I handed my purse to my brother. Did he ask for the purse? He held out his hand. But didn't say anything. His hand out as if you have to hand him the purse.
To answer the court's question, no, I don't believe A, that that would be overwhelming evidence, and two, the gravamen of robbery is the taking, and the taking is complete at that point. Mr. White is running. There was testimony that he was concerned about being in the same place as Mr. Santisteban, who was a parolee, and he was concerned about being in the same location as him while he was on parole. There was testimony that he did not ask for the purse, he did not call out for it. She did testify that she handed him the purse after it had already been taken.
Why doesn't that constitute aiding or abetting? I mean, the purse is taken. The testimony is uncontroverted that it wasn't volunteered, and he runs away with it. Why isn't that overwhelming evidence of guilt as to robbery?
A couple of things, Your Honor. One, there is a point in the cross-examination, and I recognize it is only that point where defense counsel asks Miss White at some point at some point, does she just hand it to you? And she says yes. So it's possible, depending on how the jury were to hear that and interpret that, that they could construe there being a break in the chain of events, the causal chain of the events, such that the ultimate handing is independent of any force, threat, coercion, intimidation. So there's that. Number two, the purse, assuming for the sake of argument that the purse was forcibly removed from from Ms. Charisse's possession, it's taken. The act of possession is over. With the act of taking is over, and the crime of robbery is completed. So handing it to him, and she hands it to him, as opposed to him reaching out and taking it from her, is my recall, would not be aiding, abetting, or in furtherance of the crime of robbery. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, representing the people in this matter. Just briefly on the standard of review for the complicity instruction claim, the standard of review is plain error. Tendering an alternate instruction isn't enough to preserve an objection, and I believe the case the defendant relied on to support that argument involved counsel tendering a jury instruction and also making an argument in support of it. But I think in any event, any objection the defendant may have had from tendering the alternate instruction was waived when he expressly approved the instruction given to the jury.
Do you have a case that specifically says that tendering an instruction other than what the trial court ends up giving isn't sufficient to preserve the error?
I'm sorry, what your question is whether that...
Do you have a Colorado case that says tendering an instruction when the trial court ends up giving a different instruction isn't sufficient to preserve the error?
I think we have kind of the inverse of that. We have saying, you know, tendering an instruction may be enough if you make an argument in support of the instruction.
My question is, do you have a case that says merely tendering an instruction isn't enough?
I believe I cited one in my brief, but I could be wrong on that point. I'd have to check.
Is it your position there's overwhelming evidence of guilt as to the robbery?
Yes, that is my position. So if you'd like me to address the merits of that claim, I'll move to that. I think there are really two ways that we can get to no plain error in this case. One, we can say there's no plain error if the instructions and argument as a whole inform the jury of the relevant law. And then we can also get there by saying there's no plain error if the element is either undisputed or there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. And I think both of those prongs are present in this case. We know that the element was undisputed because the defendant's theory of the case was that he was assisting his sister. So the element that the defendant was contesting was not that he took an act to aid or abet her. What he was contesting was his intent. He's saying, you know, the assistance that I provided was not in furtherance of a robbery. It was in furtherance of my sister regaining her purse that she believed was hers. And, you know, and to that end, he submitted the theory of the case instruction to support it. And then he also asserted a mistake of fact defense, which is also conceding that he was providing assistance just under a mistake of fact. And I think there's also overwhelming evidence of guilt in addition to that element being undisputed. And I'll just briefly go through the testimony on that point. And initially, I will say I think there's fairly strong evidence that the defendant was guilty as a principal as to the robbery based on the victim's testimony. But for the purpose of addressing the complicity claim, I'm only going to focus on the overwhelming evidence of complicity, which was that Monique, who is the defendant's sister, testified that she and the defendant were waiting for the victim at the apartment complex. And when the victim got out of the car, both of them chased after her. Monique testified the defendant got to the victim first, and she saw the defendant standing over the victim, who was on the ground. Monique testified that after she took the purse from the victim, the defendant reached out his hand to take the purse. And then a disinterested witness flagged down the police after observing the victim on the ground, and the defendant and Monique standing over her, and the defendant with a purse in his hands. And then when the police arrived, the defendant fled and was apprehended with the purse in his hands. So I think to summarize, The disputed issue in this case was the defendant's intent, not his conduct. And therefore, there's no reasonable possibility that the omission of the element that he aided or assisted Monique contributed to his conviction, because there was overwhelming evidence that he helped. It was just a question of whether he intended to help with a robbery or a lawful repossession.
Is that consistent with the defendant's closing argument?
Well, I think the defendant's closing argument was that he, and I think I quoted a piece of it. This was the defendant's closing argument. Lance White did not rob. This is a quote. Lance White did not steal. Lance White did not commit a crime. He simply assisted his sister, Monique White, with repossessing her stolen items. So he's conceding the conduct. He's conceding that he was assisting. And the question is his intent? And there's no question that the jury was adequately instructed on his intent. And I think just, you know, if you look at the elements of the complicity instruction, and, you know, I agree it's missing the element that he aided or abetted. But I think, you know, as a matter of logic here, there was no direct evidence of the defendant's intent. And so the only way the jury is going to get to the fact that he had the criminal intent to assist his sister in the robbery is by finding that his conduct assisted her. So I think you can conclude, based on the instruction given, along with, you know, an instruction about the voluntary act and a definition of aiding, that the defendant, that the jury would have found that element. I think if the court has no further questions, the people would ask you to affirm.
First, if I could direct the court's attention to People v. Miller, 113 Pacific 3rd, 743 at 747, decided by the Colorado Supreme Court in 2005, which was cited by the people in their answer brief as to whether or not this issue was preserved. The Colorado Supreme Court noted Miller did not object to the instruction or tender alternative instructions. And there are other cases which are cited in my briefs which talk about the appellant and failing to tender the instruction and therefore not preserving the issue for appeal. So I believe that there's ample case law for this court to find that tendering the instruction, as well as raising the arguments or the citing the case of Bogdanoff, preserves this issue for appeal. The Attorney General mentioned that when Mr. White was arrested, that he had the purse in his possession. I would direct the court's attention to the April 20th, 2010, day of trial, page 69. Line 15, where I believe it states that Mr. White did not have the purse when he was arrested. The purse was found in another location of the area. When the court looks at all of the instructions as a whole, as it is required to do when analyzing this issue, there is no way to harmonize those instructions such that the jury is appropriately and accurately informed of the law to convict Mr. White on a theory of accomplice liability. And this is compounded by the closing argument that is made by the district attorney in this case, where he talks about all Mr. White has to do is aid Miss White. And then he goes on to define what he means by aid, and he talks about all he has to do is be there, all he has to do is be the muscle, all he has to do is stand by Miss White, all he has to do is intimidate Miss Charisse. The only act that the prosecution mentions in its closing argument is the act of intimidation, which again does not square with or cannot be harmonized with the instruction that the jury is given, because they're told that they have to look for what he was intending to do. Was he intending to aid, abet, encourage, or advise? So they essentially have to plug that in to that element number 5 of the accomplice liability instruction and decide, was he intending to aid, abet, encourage, or advise? And they're not looking to determine if the prosecution has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he, in fact, aided, abetted, encouraged, or advised. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. A written opinion will issue in due course.